While you're listening, go to arcpodnet.com/members and support our efforts. Let's get to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 183.
On today's show, we talk about Ice Age footprints, a Roman coin, and a new translation of an ancient script.
Let's dig a little deeper into the ancient languages of early Iran. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Where are we today?
Oh, I'm actually not sure. I mean, we're definitely in Montana, so we crossed back across the border today. Yeah. And we're next to some really lovely water with lots of trees and mountains.
It's the Kootenai Lake or Reservoir or River or something. And we're near Rexford, Montana, just south of Eureka. Or just near Eureka.
Yeah.
Montana.
Yeah. It's a really cute little camping area. And we thought we were kind of screwed, actually, out of having a place to park. Because, you know, when you're boondocking, you got to have a couple options. And, like, the first one was a hard pass. It was full of people. Second one, same thing. Hard pass full of people.
Plus, we didn't think to look, but we didn't just assume that the first Saturday in August in Eureka was the, like, their quilt festival.
Yeah.
So there's quilts and people everywhere.
Yeah. It's just the town was just packed today. So anyway, I guess we should have figured that, given that it's summer and, like, random festivals happen all the time in summer. But here's to hoping we get better luck with our boondocking spot hunting tomorrow, because we're hoping to be near Glacier National Park tomorrow.
Well, maybe when we get done recording, we can go down by the lake, and it's a little low, like all lakes are.
Yeah.
And maybe we can get our toes, walk in the muddy beach there a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And in 12,000 years, some idiot archaeologist can dig them up.
What? Why would you possibly be talking about that?
So, you may remember a podcast. We actually discussed this in our episodes 141, 142 series on pre-Clovis stuff. But there were some footprints found not too long ago in White Sands, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Footprints in the sand, so to speak.
Yep.
And, you know, hardened, of course. And some archaeologists doing some work on Hill Air Force Base in the Utah Salt Flats found some more.
Yeah. I guess it was, like, the same guy who was working in White Sands, Thomas Urban.
Yeah.
He was brought to Hill Air Force Base to work on a different project, but he's kind of become some sort of, like, fossilized footprint expert or whatever. Right. And he knows what he's looking for. So he found them.
Yeah, he was working with Far Western Anthropological Research Group, which is a CRM firm.
Yeah.
A pretty big CRM firm here on the West Coast. You know, they're based out of, I think, Davis, California.
Yeah, something like that.
But they've got offices all around the West, and they do, actually, they do a lot of big projects, a lot of big infrastructure projects, which is probably why they have a contract for working on this Air Force base.
Yeah, totally.
So Darren Duke, who's actually one of the principals at Far Western,
was with him. Okay,
Yeah, and they were just, like, driving along. And they were, I think, coming from another site that they were working at, and it was just the right time of day, and they had some moisture at some point, and they noticed some what they called ghost tracks. And it's the kind of thing where if you've ever seen something, you know, like your driveway got rain on it or something like that, and you can see scratches and things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It happens when it rains, right? Well, these footprints were more visible because of recent moisture and just the right time of day.
Yeah.
So they stopped to check them out.
Yeah, that is so cool, because I think what we're finding is that if you look for these kind of conditions, you might be able to find more footprints like these, and it might help fill in some of our prehistory that we don't know about this continent with footprints, which is really cool.
Urban noticed they were footprints right away, because he'd been really into this kind of stuff and studying it. And again, he was at White Sands, helped identify those. They came back the next day, and actually, you know, they must have been in contact with the Air Force, because you can't just start digging on an Air Force base. But they came back the next day and did some, it's cool to just have a ground penetrating radar with you.
I know, like, they could just, like, come back the next day with it, like, ready to go. And now I do some GPR.
Right.
Which, like, is, like, the whole, like stumbled upon it, like, part of the story. I'm a little bit like, was it really? Or did they, like, have an idea that maybe if they looked here and if they had this equipment available, they might find this? Like, it does feel a little bit staged almost, but that's okay. I'll give him the ghost track story.
And it's not often you're able to just immediately dig something up the next day that you find it.
Yeah.
That's not within your permitted area today.
Right, totally.
But being on an Air Force base, they can get different regulations. Yeah. If you just talk to them and say, hey, we got this thing, we need to act on it now.
And if you read the article, the Air Force base archaeologist seems very excited and involved with the discoveries too. So I'm guessing that like pushing forward excavation of this was not too hard to do.
Right. So I was a little skeptical, actually, when I first read that part about using GPR to actually find more of the more invisible footprints.
Mm-hmm.
Because ground penetrating radar, I mean, it's not a great resolution.
Right.
And
yeah.
I always just assumed it was better with things that are a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
But these footprints are not very deep. They're like,
they're practically on the surface. Yeah.
But if you know how to finely tune your GPR and you've got a good one and more importantly, you know what signature you're looking for, you know what the things that you're looking for, what they look like. And he tuned this working at White Sands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was able to find a lot more and using GPR to do that. Mm-hmm. So. And then they also excavated a few of these just to kind of take them back.
Yeah, which is really cool.
So,
well, and if you remember from the White Sands site, the reason they were able to date them the way that they did is because there was like bits of pollen in between the footprints and they had to have been there at a certain time. And I can't remember the relative dating between the pollen and the footprints allowed them to date them to at least a certain age.
Right.
So I'm guessing they excavated hoping to find something like that they could use for dating. But it doesn't sound like they were actually able to do that in this case.
Yeah. And maybe some further
testing or whatever.
Because
turn something up.
The whole point of why these footprints developed is we'll get to that. Actually, we'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. But there were about 88 trackways in total, so tracks of people walking across. It's not like everybody was headed out to, the food trucks. It was just probably multiple events, stuff like that. Could have even happened over hundreds of years.
Right.
But either way, 88 tracks in total were found, which probably means there's more out there and we just haven't found them yet. And some of the ones that they excavated, just based on the size and kind of depressions and things like that, you can tell that there were adults, and then they assumed that there were children as well, ranging from about 5 to 12 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're just guessing on size, right?
Right.
Like, basically, that's where they were coming up with that conclusion.
Yeah. So, again, like I said, how do they form? So, people were walking either in shallow water or very wet sand, and then that depression that they made with their foot filled in a little bit as they walked, and then at some point, it was just, nobody really touched it after that.
Yeah.
And then waters recede and ebb and flow and things like that. And they just hardened.
Yeah. Like that muddy layer underneath just like captured the image, or I guess it's not an image when it's like you're impressed into
it.
It's
like a negative impression.
Yeah. Basically of the footprint. And then it was preserved for us to find, however many years later.
Right. And because it was watery, you almost know that there's more than likely some sort of vegetation around, which is how, like, for the White Sands, they were able to find pollen grains and things like that.
Yep.
And, they could find the same thing here unless they're really done with that and they just didn't find anything. Maybe if they excavate some more, they'll find some stuff. But it's also possible that the preservation wasn't good enough to preserve that. It could have just dried and crumbled to dust.
Yeah, totally.
And it's just gone.
Yeah.
So this area is interesting because, it's the dry, crazy,
like
hot
salt flats
of Utah.
Yeah.
However, it used to be a wetland.
Right.
And there used to be water in the area about 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, as I say, we know that it was 10,000 years ago. So if they needed water to make these footprints, then that would mean that they have to be at least 10,000 years old, right?
Yeah. Now, given that information, they know they're at least 10,000 years old, but they're proposing they're probably around 12,000 years old. And I'm guessing that's more likely because of what they know of other sites and cultural groups in the area.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And there's often times when you can tell, especially in the Great Basin, and this isn't the Great Basin, it's on the kind of the other side of the Great Basin, but in all these basin type environments and where there were massive lakes years and years ago at the end of the Ice Age, you can see the paleo shorelines. Mm-hmm. So they can probably know where these footprints were found, about where that paleo shoreline was, given other information.
Yeah.
And deduce that it was about 12,000 years ago.
Yeah,
that's
totally.
My guess.
Yeah, the geologic markers of the area probably do help narrow things down a bit, for sure.
Yeah, and along those lines, they were in that area to begin with to excavate some Ice Age hearths.
Yeah.
Yeah, that they had found. So a lot of stuff in the same area.
I guess those hearths were only like a half mile from the footprints. So even though you don't necessarily know for sure that they're associated, mm-hmm. it does tell you that there were humans in that area half mile away. And if you know what those date to, it can kind of give you an idea of when the footprints might date to as well.
Yeah. And in one of those, they found evidence of human tobacco use, which that kind of surprises me. I didn't even know tobacco was used in that area. To be honest, right?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I guess why not, right? If it's a wetland area, you could grow green leafy plants, then sure.
Yeah. That was only about a half mile from the footprints.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, one of the big takeaways from this particular discovery of the footprints is that they're pretty much solidifying the fact that you can use GPR and some of these other techniques to find these.
Yeah.
Of course, GPR is a really slow, methodical process, mm-hmm. and you can't just GPR the whole desert.
Right.
So
you got to have a reason to go look for them.
So you still need some sort of surface expression or some sort of randomized testing mm-hmm. or something like that in order to find stuff. Mm-hmm. I really wish we had some sort of airborne subsurface detector. Mm-hmm. You know, we really don't yet. Mm-hmm. Something we could shoot from a drone or an aircraft and just kind of have a GPR effect.
Yeah.
But do it on a massive scale.
Yeah, so, totally. That would be so cool.
Yeah.
I'm thinking too about what you said about the ancient lake shores and knowing mm-hmm. where they are and when they date to. And you probably could like pinpoint certain areas that are more likely to have evidence of humans than others just based on the geologic context. Mm-hmm. So maybe that would be like a cool project for a grad student to do or something like that, to just like pick out lakeshore areas that might have footprints and just go hunting for them. That would be really cool.
There you go.
There's your next graduate project, somebody out there in the world.
Wow.
Not me.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, they don't really know exactly what those humans were doing out there, but I'm guessing it was a really dark sky and they were just trying to find their astrological signs in the sky.
Oh my God.
So maybe not. It took another 10,000 years for that to happen. All right. We're talking about Roman coins on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Hey everyone, Chris Webster from the APN here. We have used a number of solutions for recording our podcast with interesting people from around the world. None have worked better than Zencastr. For the last several years, we've been using Zencastr for high-quality recordings that are easy to do and put little to no stress on the guest. And now, Zencastr has high-quality video and even automatic transcription. So click the link in the show notes or head over to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code TAS to get 30% off your first 3 months of the Pro Plan. If you're starting a podcast anytime soon, it's totally worth it. Again, click the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months. And they even give a little back to us when you do.
Keep this conversation going by joining our members-only Slack team. There's always vibrant conversations going on over there between members and hosts about the topics we're podcasting about and more. Also get access to our back catalog of bonus material and ad-free shows. You get all this for $7.99 a month or less than $80 US per year if you get the annual subscription. Support archaeological education and outreach by supporting the APN. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for details. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Are you listening to this podcast and thinking you'd like to start your own podcast and don't know where to start? Well, Chris Webster, that's me. I'm founder of the APN, and I started podcasting back in 2011. You can learn from my years of experience, and you can do it at your own pace. Head over to propodcastnow.com and click the Learn to Podcast image. My 6 to 8 hour self-guided course will take you from show inception to your first episode, and you'll learn the tools you need to keep it all going and prevent pod fading. That's a real term. You can have access to the materials for as long as you want, and if you stay in for 3 months at least, you'll have lifetime access to the graduates Slack team so you can talk to other people that have taken the course and are managing their own podcasts. Again, head over to propodcastnow.com and click Learn to Podcast. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 183. And as I mentioned, we're talking about Roman coins and apparently the zodiac. What does that mean?
Like
all the zodiac.
Well, yeah, I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, there was a coin that was found. It's nearly 2,000 years old, and it was minted in Alexandria in Egypt during the reign of Antoninus Pius. And it was discovered in the waters around Haifa in northern Israel.
I've been there.
So, oh, have you really?
Yeah, I've been to Haifa.
That's awesome. What was it like?
It was hot and there were teenagers with machine guns.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, it's Israel. So that's how they do there.
Actually, Haifa was this was in 1996. It was a really clean, nice town.
Yeah.
I remember we went to the mall because we were in the Navy and just came off of a ship. And that was like kind of the only thing to do.
Right.
And the mall was weird and starkly like clean.
Modern.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Modern for the time, but also very clean and not very many people.
Oh,
it was weird. Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't remember the day of the week we were there, but
I just kind of imagine places like that are just like filled with ancient ruins, like everywhere.
And I'm sure they are, but I was 18 and didn't care.
Yeah.
And wasn't
yeah.
looking for anything like
right,
that.
Right, right. Totally.
Yeah, so anyway.
Well, this particular coin was part of a hoard of coins, and they were probably deposited by some sort of shipwreck that happened, but they didn't find anything else with the coins, so they don't know any more context other than it was probably a shipwreck that dropped it into the ocean.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to start keeping my money in hoards now. We don't do that enough anymore.
I know. Why is it called a bank account? It should be a bank hoard.
My hoard of ones.
My hoard. Yeah.
Up the bank. I'd like to get information. What's my hoard balance?
My hoard
Your
balance.
What, sir?
Oh, that's great.
Oh, my God. It just makes you wonder. Digital money these days, you know, like when the world all goes to hell, there's going to be trillions and trillions of fictitious dollars sitting in bank accounts that nobody can access anymore because the world went to hell. And when we reboot the world, that money's not even going to mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
It's crazy. But coins, yeah. That's the crazy thing about coins. You can find a hoard of coins from 2,000 years ago, and they're still worth money. Because
True.
They're probably gold or something else.
Yes, they're still money
yeah.
because of the material, but they're also valuable because of
the
what they are. Yeah, the antiquity. Yeah. Well, this coin in particular is very well preserved.
Yeah.
On one side of it, it has an image of Luna, the Roman goddess of the moon.
Not your sister's dog?
No, not my sister's dog. And also an image of the zodiac sign for Cancer, which is a crab. It's kind of a cute little like image on the coin. You should look at it. Go look at the pictures in the article. And on the other side, we have Antoninus Pius and the inscription for year 8. And what that means is that it was struck in the 8th year of his reign.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. It's a very exact date. I didn't know that coins like that would have such an exact date on them. And they still do today, too. It's kind of crazy that that, like, is just a continuing thing, that money just always has a date on it. But
and this was one of a series of coins because it was tied to the zodiac.
Yeah. I don't quite understand how this works. Maybe your brain can understand it better than mine, but it says it's part of a series of 13 coins that portray the 12 zodiac signs, and then the 13th would be the complete wheel. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, is it like one single special set of coins, or do all 13 coins have the same value, but they just have different images on them? Like, how exactly does a series of 13 coins work in that context?
It could be like our state quarters, collect them all.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, but like I just can't imagine.
I don't think and I could be wrong on this, but I don't think they necessarily backed the coins with like a metal, like gold or something like that, like we do today. Our coins are worthless unless they're backed by something that's valuable. But these coins, it was more by weight.
Yeah,
so I think they would just, you know, if there actually are, you know, real, this actually looks bronze, to be honest with you. So maybe it did have some sort of symbolic meaning and not an actual value to it.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it was a series of coins. And here's the question. If this was the 8th year of his reign, did they do this every year, or was this kind of like a special year?
Good question. You know? Good question. Yeah, I'm not really sure. They didn't really go into like the whole history of the coins in that time period in the article, and we didn't deep dive it. So maybe that would be a fun episode sometime to like deep dive the like history of coins and like how that really works, you know? So I didn't know this, and you told me I'm a dum-dum for not knowing this, but apparently astrology was really huge in Rome. I didn't realize that. So
the ancient world was all about it.
Yeah, I guess so. And just quickly, the backstory there is that it originated in Mesopotamia in the 3rd millennium BCE, and it just sort of spread out from there, and it was completely entrenched in Roman society, and it was the most popular divination practice, indicating that there were other divination practices other than astrology.
Yeah, more than a few.
Yeah, but this one was the most popular of them.
Yeah.
But my favorite part about it is that the emperors didn't always love astrology, because predictions could be used to undermine their authority. Like, if people didn't like something that they were doing, mm-hmm. they could just like find a prediction that was against it and yeah, disagree with the ruler that way.
I mean, I'm sure that, you know, priests and religious folk alike through time, when they started kind of understanding stuff and uh-huh. then saying things like, oh, if we have a drought, it's because we didn't do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't please this person. We right. didn't do that. I mean, that just rolls straight up to the top. Mm-hmm. And it's that guy's fault.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a history of rulers and religion not always playing well. Like, look at Henry VIII and splitting off from the Catholic Church, basically, so that he could get a divorce, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, there's a contentious history between rulers and whatever the religion of the time period was. So, yeah.
Yeah, and Antoninus Pius was one of the most peaceful Roman rulers. That probably means he only killed a few people a day in the context of Roman rulers.
Yeah.
And he ruled between a long reign, actually, 138 to 161 CE. And
yeah.
given that it's on this side of the zero line, it feels like compared to some of the other stuff we talk about, it was just not that long
ago. Not that long ago, right? Yeah. Totally. Well, yeah. I think he was pretty peaceful because he succeeded Hadrian, who was not peaceful at all.
Right. So was he peaceful, like, relatively speaking?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that guy was, like, fighting everybody. And apparently he attempted to subjugate Israel. His forces destroyed temples a couple right. times in a couple places. He also outlawed circumcision, which is a core practice in Judaism. And man, did they not take well to that. Like, there was uprisings and revolts, and Hadrian managed to beat them down every time, but it was just a contentious time. So when Pius, you know, became the ruler, it was like peace, and he lifted the ban on circumcision, and there was no more temple burnings, and like, I guess it really was peaceful considering the previous era.
It makes me think, when you think about previous eras like that, like, who was the German chancellor or whoever, like, after Hitler? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, right.
Like,
how do you follow that,
yeah,
right?
How do you follow that? Yeah. Like, I guess there's probably nothing you can do wrong.
No, I mean, if you don't kill a whole lot of people, you're probably doing pretty good to begin with.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, anyway.
That's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, I am very intrigued by ancient coins.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me want to do a bit of a deep dive to see, like, what other things they have contributed to our, like, knowledge of the ancient world. It's really interesting. So,
and it's funny, given that this is only, you know, 1900 years old, give or take,
mm-hmm.
and we still, as much as we know about Roman society, as much as we know about their language and how they spoke and all those things, we still don't really know, like you said, the coins and how they were minted and all this stuff. I mean, somebody might know, but it's not like common knowledge.
Yeah, like how they were used.
Yeah.
There's still so much to know and so much to learn, even about a culture like the Romans.
Right. But now, with our next article, there's less that we don't know.
Always a good day when that happens.
Let's learn about some ancient scripts on the other side of the break. What do you use for appointment and task scheduling? I used to constantly move things around in my calendar that were just tasks I needed to do in favor of meetings. Now I let an intelligent AI do that with Motion. In Motion, all I have to do is create tasks with a soft or hard deadline, state how long I think it will take, and whether it can be broken up, and Motion does the rest. It puts the task where it's a best fit for me getting it done by the deadline. The scheduler then puts appointments with people wherever they schedule and moves the tasks around them. Support the APN with a little kickback if you sign up, and try Motion for free at www.arcpodnet.com/motion. That's arcpodnet.com/motion.
Did you know we have lots of great shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network? Head over to arcpodnet.com and you can see all the shows that are currently producing podcasts. Scroll down a bit more and you'll see some great shows from the past that still have great content. Search for your favorite shows on your podcasting app or listen right on the page at arcpodnet.com.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 183. What do you know about linear Elamite? Elamite.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love this article so very much. It feels like so, I don't know, like it's like a breakthrough almost.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the title. Have scholars finally deciphered a mysterious ancient script? Of course, attention grabbing, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But the answer is maybe they did. So linear Elamite is an obscure script from ancient Iran, and it was used by the Elam civilization. They occupied most of southwestern Iran, and they were called the Elamites by neighboring Sumerians. So that's how we know them as that name, because the Sumerians, you know, they have had a written language for a long time that we have deciphered. So that's where that comes from. And their main sort of hub or main city was called Susa. And there's been a lot of excavation there, and we found a lot of things related to the city. So, well, we know about the city. We know a lot is going on there. There's all these tablets that have been found, but the language on the tablets have not been deciphered until now.
Yeah, they lived around, what, 5,000 years ago?
Yeah, it looks like they began around then. And it was located between Sumeria and Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley civilizations in, like, that Southeast Asia, Pakistan, Northern India type of area.
Right.
So we don't know that much about them, even though there's been excavations and stuff that have gone on there probably for at least a century or so. But we don't, like, know a huge amount about them. They were a small civilization, so there's not a whole lot to be found to begin with. And deciphering their language just would be, like, a really helpful thing.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's clearly very old, too. So we would just get a lot more insight into, like, writing systems and how people use the symbols that they use and stuff like that. So that would be really great.
And they were part of one of the first groups of cities, so to speak, to even use written symbols,
it sounds like. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it kind of all, like, started in that Mesopotamia area, right?
Right.
And it was because these cities were quickly growing, and they needed a way to administer and manage the, like, the growing population of people that were living in one area together, and they had to do something.
I mean, that's what it says, but this all comes down to the only reason we ever develop laws or anything like that is it's like, you have my money and I can prove it.
I know, right?
Pay me back right now.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it really probably is. And you need ways to document that. You need ways to document, you know, when people are working, when they're not working. And it's all that sort of management that drives development in this case.
It's like when all of a sudden you're not just responsible for growing your own food and feeding your own family, but, like, you're doing something and getting paid for that job, or making something and selling that thing. Like, all of a sudden you have trade, and then you've got to keep track of it. So it just totally makes sense that in these areas, that's where we see the first writing systems develop.
Yeah.
In Sumeria, that is the oldest one, of course, I think, that has ever been found. And other Mesopotamian civilizations as well. But I think Sumerians are the oldest.
Yeah, and they used around 3100 BCE, what we call wedge-shaped marks on wet clay. And the name of that is cuneiform.
Right.
Almost everybody's probably heard of that, to be honest. Yeah, and if you imagine, it's actually kind of cool the way that it happens. They used reeds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the shape of a reed, like a grass reed that you find in, like, a waterway.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The shape of the end of the reed, if you break it off, it's kind of got this, like, really elliptical, if not oval shape.
Yeah, I can totally envision what you're saying. Yeah.
And then you just, like, you put it into the wet clay, and the way that they would either jam it in like that or jam it in and twist and do different things, that's how they would make their symbols.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah, so they used both symbols and logograms. And logograms are images, right? So I think what that means is, like, there's symbols for the different sounds in words sometimes, but then there's also, like, just an image which represents something specifically.
Wait, they didn't develop complex math too, like logarithms, just logograms?
I mean, maybe. No. It seems like these guys were pretty amazing, but... So the cuneiform script, it was later adapted for many of the societies in this area. Hittite, Akkadians, they all used sort of a version of the Sumerian cuneiform for their written languages as well.
I think we talked about something Akkadian in one of our episodes.
We did. It was part of a Timelines or something, I think. Yeah.
Write it and let us know. Bonus points.
Right. So cuneiform has been translated for a really long time, since the 19th century, and it's offered insights into economics, structure, the people in general that were using this script. Just like you said, like, they had to have a way to keep track of all this stuff. And now that we know how they were keeping track of that stuff, it just gives us so much more insight into what life was like back then. It's really helpful to have the language deciphered.
Yeah, exactly.
In Elam, archaeologists found tablets in the, like, main city area of Susa that were just as old as the Sumerian tablets that had previously been found. But the script is totally different. It's clearly a completely different language. And it's not been deciphered until potentially now.
Yeah. And the earliest ones that we have of this
new language, I guess.
Yeah. It's called Proto-Elamite.
Right.
Yeah. So like the early one. Right?
Yeah.
And apparently that fell out of fashion at some point and was abandoned. And I'm guessing one of the reasons for that might be is just common languages, common communication forms.
Probably.
Somebody was using something else that just made more sense.
Yeah, definitely. And like to have an 800-year gap, I mean, they were still communicating it in some way in between there. So it might just be that we haven't found whatever it is that fills in that gap too. So gaps, I don't think are this like horrible thing that some people might make them out to be. It just means that we haven't filled in the hole yet, but not that there was nothing there.
Yeah. And what you're talking about, the 800-year gap when the Proto-Elamite fell out was when linear Elamite was developed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
exactly.
Again, it wasn't just like somebody woke up some one morning and said, you know what? We haven't been like writing anything for 800 years. Let's develop a new language.
Now let's do it.
Yeah. So it really is, it probably developed over time and whoever was probably more than likely the more wealthy or well-known, you know, merchants or whoever, or even leaders probably said, we're going to use this now.
Oh, totally. You know, that's always how it goes, right?
Yeah, we need a common frame of reference here. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to bet we just don't have evidence for that yet. So there might not be, there's probably isn't an 800-year gap between Proto-Elamite and linear Elamite where nothing was used.
Right.
It just either evolved slowly into that and now we can see the change or we just haven't seen all the pieces to the puzzle yet.
Totally.
Yeah.
So one really interesting thing, though, is that they have found more than, or archaeologists in general over the last 100 years or so have found more than 1,600 Proto-Elamite inscriptions or tablets.
Yeah.
However, they have only found about 43 of the linear Elamites.
Crazy.
Isn't that insane? Yeah. So like it does make you wonder what was going on in that gap and then why are there only so few of the linear Elamites? But you just can't explain everything, right?
Yeah.
So neither language obviously has been deciphered until now, potentially. And this is where French archaeologist François Desset comes in. He believes he has deciphered linear Elamite.
Yeah.
And now you might be wondering, why would he choose the one where there's only 43 tablets to decipher rather than the one where there's 1,600 of them? Mm-hmm. But the reason is because he basically gained access to a private collection of silver vessels with inscriptions on them. These vessels are, as you might guess, of suspect provenance because they are in a private collection and there's no more mentioned about that. I think probably even their age and authenticity might be a little bit in question, which is one of the critiques of this work is that the provenance is suspect. So how can we be sure that they are what they are? So that's a big red flag, although not terrible, I don't think.
Yeah.
He believes that they date to around 2000 BCE, and they are basically like the Rosetta Stone jackpot for linear Elamite because they have royal names on them in both linear Elamite and the Sumerian cuneiform, which of course has already been translated.
Yeah.
So we already know what those symbols are and what they mean, and it tells us what the linear Elamite ones mean because they're associated, so you know which one it is, which name it is. And then from that name, those names, they can unravel like the rest of the language from there.
And one of the cool things about how they actually translated these things is by looking at the names of kings.
Yeah.
And that's actually how they did the translations of hieroglyphics on the Rosetta Stone.
On the Rosetta Stone, right?
Because it was known for quite some time that Egyptians put the names of leaders in an oval. They called it a cartouche.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so everything within that was the name of a king.
Okay.
And once you really learn through other means what the names of kings were, and queens for that matter, in certain areas, and you've got some pronunciation, you can start to pull that out.
Symbols and the sounds and like find them in other places. And then through contextual clues, probably you can start like putting together the language.
Yeah. And by doing this, they learned a number of symbols because people's names have, you know, you get different names and they contain similar elements of the language.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they could read 72 linear Elamite symbols, which is more than 96% of those that are known about right now.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, just by doing that.
Yeah.
It's really difficult because we don't really have context and we don't know what they sounded like because nobody speaks that language.
Exactly.
But
aside
from that.
Yeah. I mean, there's still so much more work to be done here. And there's a lot of skepticism, and I think rightly so. Like, you do need to have skepticism when a brand new discovery like this happens. or a brand new translation.
Right.
And that's part of the skepticism, is that they haven't fully translated any other tablets or anything like that. There's still a lot more like on the ground, like just hunched over inscriptions of tablets kind of translation that needs to happen to verify that what they think is true is actually true. And so, yeah, there's just more time to go for that. There needs to be peer-reviewed papers and things need to be published, papers given, all that kind of stuff that goes along with a big discovery like this. So another interesting thing that Doucette says is that he is arguing that this is a symbol language only, no logograms like cuneiform and hieroglyphics. And because of that, it would make it the oldest known writing system to not incorporate logograms. Mm-hmm. Previously, Phoenicians and the alphabet they used was thought to be the oldest at 1100 BCE. So this pushes it back another like 800 years or so, I think, around there.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is that's leading to more of an alphabet like we know today. Because yeah. We also don't use logograms in English. They're all
it's letters. All symbols, it's right? It's yeah. Symbols. Yeah. You should totally go look at the pictures in the article, because like it really is truly symbols. Now, they're not symbols at all like anything that we use in our alphabet, obviously, but they're not images, not really. You don't see any eyes like you do in hieroglyphics and all the other kind of symbols that mean something more than just a sound in the other languages. They're just straight symbols.
Well, it makes me wonder if this was maybe a more advanced form of something that we, again, haven't found yet. Mm-hmm. Because like hieroglyphics, yeah, there's a lot of images that you can really tell. Oh, that looks like an eye. That looks like a bird.
Right.
Something like that.
Right.
But there's a cursive written form of hieroglyphics that develops.
Oh, yeah.
And that starts to get more into less symbolic and more less logogrammic, I guess.
And more symbolic. Symbol. Yeah.
And, you know, some of these shapes and things they have here. Yeah, we might know what they are.
True.
But they could have developed from more defined shapes into these more abstract representations of real things. So
yeah,
it's
definitely
say.
Possible. Yeah. Well, and it's arguments like that is why there's just a lot of skepticism about that claim in general. And I think there just needs to be a lot more research before it can be said for sure that that's accurate. So, yeah. Another interesting point that Doucette makes is that he thinks that the Proto-Elamite language is actually a predecessor of the Linear Elamite. And there's a lot of people who feel like they are not related, and that the earlier one fell out of favor. There was an 800 year gap and then something new came up in its place. But he thinks that they're related because he sees some similarities between the symbols and stuff like that. But the earlier one does use logograms, whereas it looks like the later one does not. Again, there's just a lot of like unknowns around this, and it's just very early days in this translation. I think a lot more work and research needs to happen. So it could rewrite the history of writing systems, though, if it is true.
Every archaeological discovery of the century rewrites
something.
We know. Crazy.
Well, what's interesting about this is that we've known about these languages.
Yeah.
We've known how old they are. That's not news to anybody. It's just that we couldn't decipher them. Mm-hmm. And when you can't decipher something, it just puts this big question mark on top of it. And you can't work it into like the timeline with everything else, you know? I mean, you can, but you can't really, because you don't know what they say. So it is really like a huge thing if these translations are as accurate as Doucette is saying they are. So
And I don't know about rewriting the history of writing systems, but it could push back, you know, like they said, the earliest symbolic language, you know, which would be big, but a bigger thing that I hope we find someday in the future, man, getting into like linguistics and writing would be super fun if I had to do it all over again.
It seems very interesting.
Because I would want to look at parallels and start looking around, you know, different areas and say, well, did this actually, are elements of this language seen in other languages? And, you know, because, you know, as people get conquered and people move and trade, that elements from some languages move into others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just how it happens.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, we've got in English lots of words that have been ripped off from other languages.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it definitely happens. So. And with the close association with Sumerians and the cuneiform language, I mean, you got to guess that there was some crossover there. Like, that certainly could have happened. So it kind of muddies the waters when you're talking about who's the earliest and all those kinds of things. Yeah. Because the Proto-Elamite is contemporaneous with the ancient Sumerian and the earliest examples that we have of it. So it would be interesting to see if there is crossover between them.
Well, and there was a lot of trade going back and forth back then. You know that there's more than likely the case that everybody, if not spoke similar languages, they at least understood each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably developed as trade became more heavy between these groups, right, as you move through time. I mean, yeah, languages were just blending, and so were writing systems, more than likely, because it doesn't do you any good to have a contract or something written in a language you don't understand.
Yeah, totally. You could say anything, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that is true, because both of these languages that we're talking about, both Elamite languages, fall out of favor at some point and cuneiform takes over.
Yeah.
So that definitely does happen eventually. So it's interesting that they maintained enough autonomy long enough that they had their own language. But yeah, it definitely didn't last forever, and cuneiform became the champion of the area.
For sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's it for now.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll be back next week with something crazy, and I don't even know where we're going to be.
Yeah. We have no idea. So you never know what you're going to get from us these days. We're doing so much traveling. It's just, you know, a new thing, a new party every week.
Yeah. And speaking of a party, let's celebrate the new members we've had in the last couple of weeks. We've actually had probably seven or eight new members in the last just few days, actually.
Oh, that's so exciting.
So thanks. If you're a listener to the Archaeology Show, thanks for that. Yes. Don't forget to check the Slack channel for ad-free versions of these shows, links to those, and then, you know, anything else that we have on there, and conversations with our other members.
Yeah, definitely. And we will put some time into more bonus episodes. It's coming. It'll happen.
And just a plug out there, you know, we have a lot of listeners from the United States. Our second sort of highest group of listeners is from the UK. And then our third is from Australia. And I don't think we have any Australian members from Australia. Like, I know there's at least a couple of people in Australia that are listening to this show. But as of yet, I'm pretty sure we don't have any members from Australia. So arcpodnet.com/members. And you can find out. So,
wow. Yeah. Calling out the Australians.
I'm just saying. Somebody's got to lead the charge.
Oh, my gosh.
So, all right. So we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
And it was used by the Elam...
Civilization. This is Chris Webster, founder of the APN and one of the chief editors. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you want to keep the conversation going and support us along the way, go to arcpodnet.com/members. That's arcpodnet.com/members. And thanks for listening.